It would be easy. It wouldn't take much effort. She could do it quickly enough that there'd be no sound. She could kill them both, right here, in Conference Room 5B. Thinking this, she feels very far from the table where Daniel's mouth is still flapping open and closed like a goldfish. She is in a high and lofty realm, a place where the lungs fill with ice crystals and everything is very clear and clean. It scarcely matters what is actually happening. She could kill them. That is the profound truth of it. She lets the power tickle at her fingers, scorching the varnish on the underside of the table. She can smell its sweet chemical aroma. Nothing that either of these men says is really of any great significance, because she could kill them in 3 moves before they stirred in their comfortably padded chairs. It doesn't matter that she shouldn't, that she never would. What matters is that she could, if she wanted. The power to hurt is a kind of wealth. She speaks quite suddenly across Daniel, sharp, like the knock at a door. "Don't waste my time with this, Daniel," she says. He's not her superior, they are equals. He can't fire her. He's talking as if he could. She says, "You and I both know that no one has an answer yet. If you've got a great idea, let's hear it. Otherwise..." She lets it dangle. Daniel opens his mouth as if to say something and then closes it again. Under her fingertips, on the underside of the table, the varnish is softening, curling, crumbling to fall in soft flakes onto the thick pile carpet. "I didn't think so," she says. "Let's work together on this one, okay, buddy? No sense throwing each other to the wolves." Margot is thinking about her future. "You're going to pump my gas someday, Daniel. I've got big plans." "Yeah," he says. "Yeah." She thinks, that is how a man speaks. And that is why.
Audio guide for the Museum of Post-Cataclysm Artifacts. This climate-controlled display case contains a very fragile leather glove, stitched together with goat sinew. Long wires extend from 3 fingertips, while 2 glove fingers are damaged. The display text reads, "Rudimentary weapon, approximately 1,000 years old. The wires are intended to conduct the power, possibly used in battle or for punishment. Discovered in a gravesite in Old Westchester."
"8 years to go.
Annie. Not very many miracles are required. Not for the Vatican. Not for a group of highly strung teenage girls cooped up together for months and in fear of their lives. You don't need so many miracles. 2 is plenty. 3 is an abundance. There is a girl, Luann. She's very pale with red hair and a dusting of freckles across her cheeks. She's only 14. She arrived 3 months before, and she's a particular friend of Gordy's. They share a bed in the dorm room. For warmth. "It gets awful cold at nights," says Gordy, and Luann smiles, and the other girls laugh and nudge each other in the ribs. She's not well. Hasn't been since before her power came in. And no doctor can help her. There is a thing that happens to her when she gets excited or scared or laughs too much. Her eyes roll back in her head and she falls to the ground wherever she is and starts to shake like she'll crack her own back. "You just have to hold her," Gordy says. "Just put your arms around her shoulders and hold her until she wakes. She'll wake by herself, you just have to wait." She often sleeps for an hour or more. Gordy has sat with her, arm around Luann's shoulders, in the refectory at midnight, or in the gardens at 6 a.m, waiting for her. Ali has a feeling about Luann, a tingling sense of something. She says, "Is this the one?" The voice says, "I'm thinking so." One night, there's a lightning storm. It starts way out at sea. The girls watch it with the nuns, standing on the deck at the back of the convent. The clouds are blue-purple. The light is hazy. The lightning strikes 1, 2, 3 times on the face of the ocean. It gives you an itchy feeling in your skein to watch a lightning storm. All the girls are feeling it. Savannah can't help herself. After a few minutes, she lets go an arc into the wood of the deck. "Stop that," says Sister Veronica. "Stop that at once." "Veronica," says Sister Maria Ignatia, "she didn't do any harm." Savannah giggles, lets off another little jolt. It's not that she couldn't stop it if she really tried. It's just that there's something exciting about the storm, something that makes you want to join in. "No meals for you tomorrow, Savannah," says Sister Veronica. "If you cannot control yourself in the slightest, our charity does not extend to you." Sister Veronica has already had one girl thrown out who would not stop fighting on the convent grounds. The other nuns have ceded this to her. She can pick and choose those in whom she detects the devil working. But no meals tomorrow is a harsh sentence. Saturday is meatloaf night. Luann tugs on Sister Veronica's sleeve.
"Please," she says. "She didn't mean it."
"Don't touch me, girl." Sister Veronica pulls her arm away, gives Luann a little shove back. But the storm has already done something to Luann. Her head jerks back and to the side in the way they all know. Her mouth opens and closes, but no sound comes out. She falls backwards, smack onto the deck. Gordy runs forward, and Sister Veronica blocks the way with her cane. "Leave her," says Sister Veronica. "But, sister..." "We have done quite enough pandering to this girl. She should not have welcomed the thing into her body, and as she has done, she will have to deal with the consequences." Luann is fitting on the deck, slamming the back of her head into the wooden boards. There's blood in the bubbles of saliva at her mouth. The voice says,
"Go on. You know what to do."
Ali says, "Sister Veronica, may I try to stop her making a fuss?" Sister Veronica blinks down at Eve, the quiet and hard-working girl Ali has pretended to be for all these months. She shrugs. "If you think you can stop this nonsense, Eve, be my guest." Ali kneels down next to Luann's body. The other girls look at her like she's a traitor. They all know it's not Luann's fault. Why is Eve pretending she can do anything? Ali can feel the electricity inside Luann's body, in her spine and in her neck and inside her head. She can feel the signals going up and down, stuttering, trying to right themselves, confused and out of sync. She can see it, clear as with her own eyes. There's a blockage, here and here and this part. Just at the base of the skull is mistiming what it's doing. It'd only take a tiny adjustment, an amount of power you wouldn't even feel, the kind of quantity that no one else can fractionate down to. Only a tiny thread, right here, to set it right. Ali cradles Luann's head in her palm, puts her little finger in the notch at the base of the skull, reaches out with a fine tendril of power, and flicks at it. Luann opens her eyes. Her body stops convulsing all at once. She blinks. She says,
"What happened?"
And they all know this is never how it goes. That Luann should have slept for an hour or more. That she might be confused for a week. Abigail says,
"Eve healed you. She touched you and you were healed."
And this was the first sign, and at this time they came to say, "This one is special to the heavens." They bring her other girls in need of healing. Sometimes she can lay her hands on them and feel out their pain. Sometimes it is just that something is hurting that need not hurt. A headache, a twitching muscle, a giddiness. Ali, the no-account girl from Jacksonville, has practiced enough that Eve, The calm and quiet young woman can lay her hands upon a person's body and find just the right place to send out a needle of power and set something to rights, at least for a while. The cures are real, even if they are only temporary. She cannot teach the body to do its work better, but she can correct its mistakes for a time. So they start to believe in her, that there is something within her. The girls believe it anyway, if not the nuns. Savannah says,
"Is it God, Eve? Is God speaking to you? Is God inside you?"
She says it quietly one evening in the dormitory after lights out. The other girls are all listening, pretending to be asleep in their own beds. Eve says, "What is it you think?" Savannah says,
"I think you have the power to heal in you, like we read in scripture."
There's a muttering around the dormitory, but no one disagrees. The next night, as they're getting ready for bed, Eve says to around 10 of the other girls, "Come with me down to the seashore tomorrow at dawn." They say,
"What for?"
She says, "I heard a voice saying, 'Go to the seashore at dawn.'" The voice says, "Well played, girl. You say what you need to say." The sky is pale blue-gray as a pebble, and feathered with cloud. The sound of the ocean is quiet as a mother shushing her baby when the girls walk down to the shore in their nightgowns. Allie speaks in Eve's voice, which is soft and low. She says, "The voice has told me that we should wade out into the water." Gordy laughs and says, "What is this, Eve? You want to go swimming?" Luann shushes her with her finger to Gordy's lips. Luann has not had a seizure that lasted more than a few seconds since Eve placed her thumb to the nape of her neck. Abigail says, "What shall we do then?" Eve says, "Then God will show us what she wants of us." And this, she, is a new teaching, and very shocking. But they understand it, each of them. They have been waiting to hear this good news. The girls wade out into the water, their nightgowns and pajamas sticking to their legs, wincing as their feet find sharp rocks, giggling a little, but with a holy feeling that they can see on one another's faces. Something is going to happen out here. The dawn is breaking. They stand in a circle. They are all up to their waists, hands trailing in the cold, clear brine. Eve says, "Holy Mother, show us what you want of us. Baptize us with your love and teach us how to live." And each of the girls around the circle suddenly feels their knees buckle under them, as if a great hand were pressing on their backs, pushing them down, ducking their heads into the ocean to rise up, water fountaining from their hair, gasping and knowing that God has touched them and that this day they are born anew. They all fall to their knees in the water. They all feel the hand pressing them down. They all know for a moment that they will die here under the water. They cannot breathe. And then, when they are lifted up, they are reborn. They stand in the circle, wet-headed and amazed. Only Eve remained standing, dry in the water. They felt the presence of God around them and among them, and she was glad. And the birds flew above them, calling out in glory for a new dawn. There were around 10 girls in the ocean that morning to witness the miracle. They had not been before that moment, leaders in the group of 5 dozen young women dwelling with the nuns. They were not the charismatic ones, not the most popular or the funniest, or the prettiest or the cleverest girls. They were, if anything drew them together, the girls who had suffered the most. their stories being particularly terrible. Their knowledge of what one might fear from others and oneself, particularly acute. Nonetheless, after that morning, they were changed. Eve swears those girls to secrecy about what they have seen. Nonetheless, the girls cannot but pass it on. Savannah tells Kayla, and Kayla tells Megan, and Megan tells Danielle that Eve has been speaking with the creator of all things, that she has secret messages. They come to ask for her teachings. They say, "Why do you call God she?" Eve says, "God is neither woman nor man, but both these things. But now she has come to show us a new side to her face, one we have ignored for too long." They say, "But what about Jesus?" Eve says, "Jesus is the Son, but the Son comes from the Mother. Consider this, which is greater, God or the world?" They say, for they have learned this already from the nuns, "God is greater, because God created the world." Eve says, "So the one who creates is greater than the thing created?" They say, "It must be so." Then Eve says, "So which must be greater, the Mother or the Son?" They pause, because they think her words may be blasphemy. Eve says, "It has already been hinted in Scripture. It has already been told to us that God came to the world in a human body. We have already learned to call God Father. Jesus taught that." They admit that this is so. Eve says, "So I teach a new thing. This power has been given to us to lay straight our crooked thinking. It is the Mother, not the Son, who is the emissary of heaven. We are to call God Mother. God the Mother came to earth in the body of Mary, who gave up her child, that we could live free from sin. God always said she would return to earth, and she has come back now to instruct us in her ways." They say, "Who are you?" And Eve says, "Who do you say that I am?" Allie says in her heart, "How am I doing?" The voice says, "You're doing just fine." Allie says, "Is this your will?" The voice says, "Do you think a single thing could happen without the will of God?" "There's going to be more than this, sweetheart. Believe me." In those days, there was a great fever in the land, and a thirst for truth, and a hunger to understand what the Almighty meant by making this change in the fortunes of mankind. In those days in the South, there were many preachers who explained it. "This is a punishment for sin. This is Satan walking amongst us. This is the sign of the end of days." But all these were not the true religion. For the true religion is love, not fear. The strong mother cradling her child, that is love, and that is truth. The girls pass this news from one to the next to the next. God has returned, and her message is for us, only us. In the early morning of a day a few weeks later, there are more baptisms. It is the spring, near to Easter, the festival of eggs and fertility and the opening of the womb, Mary's festival. When they come from the water, they do not care to hide what has happened to them, nor could they if they tried. By breakfast, all the girls know, and all of the nuns. Eve sits under a tree in the garden, and the other girls come to talk to her. They say, "What shall we call you?" And Eve says, "I am only the messenger of the Mother." They say, "But is the Mother in you?" And Eve says, "She is in all of us." But even still, the girls begin to call her Mother Eve. That night, there is a great debate between the nuns of the Sisters of Mercy. Sister Maria Ignatia, who the others note is a particular friend of that girl, Eve, speaks in favor of the new organization of beliefs. It is just the same as it has always been, she says. The mother and the son, it is just the same. Mary is the mother of the church. Mary is the queen of heaven. It is she who prays for us now and at the hour of our death. Some of these girls had never been baptized. They have taken it into their heads to baptize themselves. Can this be wrong? Sister Catherine speaks of the Marian heresies and the need to wait for guidance. Sister Veronica hauls herself to her feet and stands, straight as the true cross, in the center of the room. "The devil is in this house," she says. "We have allowed the devil to take root in our breasts and make his nest in our hearts. If we do not cut the canker out now, we shall all be damned." She says it again, more loudly, casting her glance from woman to woman in the room. "Damned! If we do not burn them as they burn these girls in Decatur and Shreveport, the devil will take us all. It shall be utterly consumed." She pauses. She is a powerful speaker. She says, "I shall pray on it this night. I shall pray for you all. We will lock the girls in their rooms until dawn. We should burn them all." The girl who has been listening at the window brings this message to Mother Eve, and they wait to hear what she will say. The voice says, "You've got them now, girl." Mother Eve says, "Let them lock us in. The Almighty will work her wonders." The voice says, "Doesn't Sister Veronica realize that any of you could just open the window and climb down the drain pipe?" And Allie says in her heart, "It is the will of the Almighty that she has not realized it." The next morning, Sister Veronica is still at prayer in the chapel. At 6, when the other sisters file in for vigils, she is there, prostrate before the cross, her arms outstretched, her forehead touching the cool stone tile. It is only when they lean forward to touch her arm gently that the women see that the blood has settled in her face. She has been dead for many hours. A heart attack. The kind of thing that could happen at any moment to a woman of her age. And, as the sun rises, they look towards the figure on the cross, and they see that, engraved now into his flesh, traced with scored lines as if carved with a knife, are the fern-like markings of the power. And they know that Sister Veronica was taken in the moment that she witnessed this miracle, and so had repented of all her sin. The Almighty has returned as promised, and she dwells in human flesh again. This day is for rejoicing. There are messages from the Holy See calling for calm and order, but the atmosphere among the girls in the convent is such that no mere message could bring stillness. There is the feeling of a festival in the building. All the ordinary rules seem to have been suspended. The beds go unmade. The girls take what foods they want from the pantry without waiting for meal times. There is singing and the playing of music. There is a glitter in the air. By lunchtime, 15 more girls have asked for the baptism, and by the afternoon they have received it. There are nuns who protest and say they'll call in the police, but the girls laugh and strike them with their jolts until they run away. In the late afternoon, Eve speaks to her congregation. They record it on their cell phones and send it across the world. Mother Eve wears a hood, the better to preserve her humility, for it is not her message she preaches, but the message of the mother. Eve says, "Do not be afraid. If you trust, then God will be with you. She has overturned heaven and earth for us. They have said to you that man rules over woman, as Jesus rules over the church. But I say unto you that woman rules over man as Mary guided her infant son, with kindness and with love. They have said to you that his death wiped away sin. But I say unto you that no one's sin is wiped away, but that they join in the great work of making justice in the world. Much injustice has been done, and it is the will of the Almighty that we gather together to put it right. They have said to you that man and woman should live together as husband and wife, but I say unto you that it is more blessed for women to live together, to help one another, to band together and be a comfort one to the next. They have said to you that you must be contented with your lot, but I say unto you that there will be a land for us, a new country. There will be a place that God will show us where we will build a new nation, mighty and free. One of the girls says,
But we can't stay here forever. And where is this new land? And what will happen when they come with the police? This isn't our place. They're not going to let us stay here. They'll take us all to jail.
The voice says, Don't you worry about that. Someone's coming. Eve says, God will send her salvation. A soldier will come, and you will be damned for your doubt. God will not forget that you did not trust her in this hour of triumph. The girl starts crying. The cell phone cameras zoom in. The girl is thrown out of the compound by nightfall. And back in Jacksonville, someone watches the news on the television. Someone sees the face behind the cow, half hidden in shadows. Someone thinks to themselves, I know that face.
Margot.
Look at this.
I am looking at it.
Have you read it?
Not all of it.
This isn't some third world country, Margot.
I know that.
This is Wisconsin.
I can see that.
This is happening in goddamn Wisconsin? This?
Try to keep calm, Daniel.
They should shoot those girls. Just shoot them in the head. Bam! End of story.
You can't shoot all the women, Daniel.
It's okay, Margot. We wouldn't shoot you.
Yeah, that's comforting.
Oh, sorry. Your daughter. I forgot. I wouldn't shoot her.
Thanks, Daniel. Daniel drums his fingers on the desk. And she thinks as she finds herself thinking quite often, I could kill you for that. It becomes a constant low-level hum in her. A thought she comes back to, like a smooth stone in her pocket to rub her thumb across. There it is. Death. It's not okay to talk about shooting young women.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I just...
He gestures at the screen. They're watching a video of six girls demonstrating their power on one another. They stare into the camera. They say,
We dedicate this to the goddess.
They've learned that from some other video somewhere on the web. They shock one another to the point that one of them faints. Another is bleeding from the nose and ears. This goddess is some kind of internet meme, stoked by the existence of the power, by anonymous forums, and by the imaginations of young people, which are now what they have always been and ever shall be. There is a symbol. It is a hand like the hand of Fatima, the palm containing an eye, the shock tendrils extending from the eye like extra limbs, like the branches of a tree. There are spray-painted versions of this symbol appearing now on walls and railway sidings and motorway bridges, high out-of-the-way places. Some of the internet message boards are encouraging the girls to get together to do terrible things. The FBI is trying to close them down, but as soon as one goes, another springs up to take its place. Margot watches the girls on the screen, playing with their power, screaming as they take a hit, laughing as they deliver one.
How's Joss?
Says Daniel at last. She's fine. She's not fine. She's having trouble with this power. No one knows enough to explain what's happening to her. She can't control the power inside her, and it's getting worse. Margot watches the girls on the screen in Wisconsin. One of them has a tattooed hand of the goddess in the center of her palm. Her friend shrieks as she applies the power, but it's not clear to Margot whether she's crying out with fear, pain, or with delight.
And we're joined in the studio today by Mayor Margot Cleary. Some of you might remember Mayor Cleary as a leader who acted swiftly and decisively after the outbreak, probably saving many lives. And she's here with her daughter, Jocelyn. How are you doing, Jocelyn? Joss shifts uneasily in her chair. These seats look comfortable, but they're actually hard. There's something sharp digging into her. The pause goes on a moment too long. I'm fine. Well, now, you have an interesting story, don't you, Jocelyn? You've been having some trouble. Margot puts a hand on Joss's knee. Like a lot of young women, she says, my daughter Jocelyn recently started experiencing the development of the power.
We have some footage of that, don't we, Kristen?
Here's the press conference on your front lawn. I believe you put a boy in the hospital, didn't you, Jocelyn? They cut to the footage of the day Margot was called home. There's Margot, standing on the steps of the mayor's residence, tucking her hair behind her ears in that way that makes her look nervous even when she's not. In the footage, she puts an arm around Joss and reads from her prepared statement. My daughter was involved in a brief altercation, she says. Our thoughts are with Laurie Vinson's and his family. We are grateful that the damage she sustained does not seem to have been serious. This is the kind of accident which is befalling many young women today. Jocelyn and I hope that everyone will remain calm and allow our family to move on from this incident.
Wow, that seems like a lifetime ago, doesn't it, Kristen?
Sure does, Tom. How did it feel, Jocelyn, when you hurt that kid? Joss has been preparing for this with her mom for more than a week now. She knows what to say. Her mouth is dry. She's a trooper. She does it anyway.
It was scary, she says. I hadn't learned how to control it. I was worried I could have really hurt him. I wish someone had shown me how to use it properly, how to control it.
There are tears starting in Joss's eyes. They hadn't rehearsed that, but it's great. The producer zooms right in, angling camera 3 to catch the glisten.
It's perfect. She's so young and fresh and beautiful and sad.
Sounds really frightening. And you think it would have helped if...
Margot steps in again. She's also looking good. Glossy, sleek hair, subtle tones of cream and brown on her eyelids, nothing too showy. She could be that lady on your block who takes care of herself, swims and does yoga. Aspirational.
That day started me thinking, Kristen, about how we can really help these girls.
The advice right now is just for them not to use their power at all.
We don't want them just letting off lightning bolts in the street now, do we?
Certainly not, Tom. But my 3-point plan is this. That's right. Assertive, effective, short sentences, a numbered list, just like on BuzzFeed. 1. Set up safe spaces for the girls to practice their power together. A trial at first in my metropolitan area, and if it's popular, statewide. 2. Identify girls who have good control to help the younger ones learn to keep their power in check. 3. Zero tolerance of usage outside these safe spaces.
There's a pause.
They've talked this through in advance. The audience listening at home will need time to adjust to what they've just heard.
So, if I understand what you're proposing, Mayor Cleary, you'd like to use public money to teach girls how to use their power more effectively.
More safely, Kristen. And I'm really here to gauge interest. In times like these, we should probably remember what the Bible says. The highest among us aren't always the wisest, and the older generation isn't always the best to judge what's right.
She smiles. Quoting the Bible, a winning strategy. Anyway, I think it's the job of government to come up with interesting ideas, don't you?
Are you suggesting some kind of training camp for these girls?
Now, Tom, you know that's not what I'm saying. It's just this. We don't let young people drive a car without getting their license, do we?
You wouldn't want the guy rewiring your house to have no training.
That's all I'm saying. Let the girls teach the girls.
But, how do we know what they'll teach them?
Tom sounding a little high-pitched now, a little afraid.
This all sounds very dangerous to me. Instead of teaching them how to use it, we should be trying to cure it. That's my bottom line.
Kristen smiles directly into the camera. But no one has a cure, do they, Tom? Says in the Wall Street Journal this morning that a multinational group of scientists is certain now that the power is caused by an environmental buildup of nerve agent that was released during the Second World War. It's changed the human genome. All girls born from now on will have the power. All of them. And they'll keep it throughout life, just like the older women do if it's woken up in them. It's too late now to try to cure it. We need new ideas. Tom tries to say something else, but Kristen just carries on. I think it's a great idea, Mayor Cleary. If you want my endorsement, I'm right behind this plan. And now, the weather on the ones.
Email from throwaway address 294-57902@gmail.com. Email to jocelyn.feinbergcleary@gmail.com. Saw you on the news today. You're having trouble with your power. You want to know why? You want to know if anyone else is having trouble too? You don't know the half of it, sister. This rabbit hole goes all the way down. Your gender-bending confusion is just the start of it. We need to put men and women back where they belong. Check out www.urbandocspeaks.com if you want to know the truth.
How fucking dare you!
There was no movement in your office, Daniel. No one was willing to listen.
So you do this? National TV, promising to roll the thing out statewide? If you remember, Margot, I am the governor of this state, and you are just the mayor of your metropolitan area. You went on national TV to talk about rolling it out statewide?
There's no law against it.
No law? No fucking law? How about, do you care about any of the agreements we have in place? How about no one's gonna find you the fucking funding for this thing if you make this number of enemies in one morning's work? How about I will personally make it my mission to block any proposal you put forward? I have powerful friends in this town, Margo, and if you think you can just railroad over the work we've done so you can become some kind of celebrity...
Calm down.
I will not... Fucking calm down! It's not just your tactics, Margot. Not just fucking going to the press. It's the whole cockeyed plan. You're gonna use public money to train basically terrorist operatives to use their weapons more effectively?
They are not terrorists. They're girls.
You wanna bet? You think there won't be some terrorists in amongst them? You've seen what happened in the Middle East, in India, in Asia. You've seen it on the TV. You want to bet your little scheme won't end up drawing in some fucking jihadis?
You done?
Am I?
Are you done? Because I have work to get on with now, so if you're finished...
No, I'm not fucking done!
But he is. Even as he stands in Margot's office, spitting onto the fine furnishings and the shaved glass awards for municipal excellence, phone calls are being made. Emails are being sent, tweets are being posted, and forum posts composed. Did you hear that lady on the morning show today? Where can I sign my girls up for that thing? I mean, seriously, I have 3 girls, 14, 16, and 19, and they are tearing each other apart. They need some place to go. They gotta let off steam. Before the week is over, Margot's received over $1.5 million in donations for her girls' camps. Some checks from worried parents, all the way up to anonymous gifts from Wall Street billionaires. There are people who want to invest in her scheme now. It's going to be a public-private initiative, a model of how government and business can work hand in glove. Before a month is done, she's found spots for the first test centres in the metropolitan area. Old schools shut down when the boys and girls were segregated, places with good-sized gymnasiums and outdoor space. 6 other state representatives arrive for informational visits so she can show them what she's planning. And before 3 months are out, people are beginning to say, you know, why doesn't that Margot Cleary run for something a little more ambitious? Get her in. Let's have a meeting. Tunde. In a dark basement, in a town in rural Moldova, a 13-year-old girl with a faint moustache on her upper lip brings stale bread and old, oily fish to a group of women huddled on dirty mattresses. She has been coming here for weeks, She is young and slow-witted. She is the daughter of the man who drives the bread truck. He keeps lookout sometimes for the men who own this house and the women who are kept here. They pay him a little for the stale bread. The women have tried asking the girl for things in the past. A cell phone. Couldn't she bring them a telephone somehow? Some paper to write a note? Could she post something for them? Just one stamp and a paper? When their families hear what's happened to them, they'll be able to pay her, please. The girl has always looked down and shaken her head fiercely, blinking her moist, stupid eyes. The women think the girl may be deaf, or she has been told to be deaf. Things have happened already to these women to make them wish they could be deaf and blind. The bread truck man's daughter empties their bucket of slops into the drain in the yard, rinses it out with a hose, and returns it to them clean, apart from a few flecks of shit under the rim. The smell will be better in here for an hour or two, at least. The girl turns to leave. When she's gone, they'll be in darkness again.
"Leave us a light,"
one of the women says.
"Don't you have a candle? A little light for us?"
The girl turns towards the door, looks up the stairs to the ground floor. No one is there. She takes the hand of the woman who spoke, turns it palm upward, and in the center of the palm, this 13-year-old girl makes a little twist with a thing that has just woken in her collarbone. The woman on the mattress, 25, and thought she was going to a good secretarial job in Berlin, gasps and shudders. Her shoulders squirm and her eyes go wide, and the hand that holds the mattress flickers with a momentary silver light. They wait in the dark. They practice. They have to be certain they can do it all in one go, that no one will have time to reach for his gun. They pass the thing from hand to hand in the dark and marvel at it. Some of them have been held captive for so long they never heard a word of this thing. For the others, it wasn't more than a strange rumour, a curiosity. They believe God has sent a miracle to save them, as he rescued the children of Israel from slavery. From the narrow places, they cried out. In the dark, they were sent light. They weep. One of the overseers comes to unshackle the woman who thought she was going as a secretary to Berlin before she was thrown down on a concrete floor and shown over and over again what her job really was. He has the keys in his hand. They fall on him all at once, and he cannot make a sound, and blood gushes from his eyes and ears. They unlock one another's bonds with his bundle of keys. They kill every man in that house, and they're still not satisfied. Moldova is the world capital of human sex trafficking. There are 1,000 little towns here with staging posts in basements and apartments, in condemned buildings. They trade in men, too, and in children. The girl children grow day by day until the power comes to their hands and they can teach the grown women. This thing happens again and again and again. The change has happened too fast for the men to learn the new tricks they need. It is a gift. Who is to say it does not come from God? Tunde files a series of reports and interviews from the Moldovan border towns where the fighting has been most acute. The women trust him because of his reports from Riyadh. Not many men could have got this close. He's been lucky, but he's also been smart and determined. He brings his other reports with him, shows them to whatever woman says she's in charge of this town or that. They want their stories told. "It wasn't just those men who hurt us," a 20-year-old woman Sonia tells him. "We killed them, but it wasn't just them. The police knew what was happening and did nothing. The men in the town beat their wives if they tried to bring us more food. The mayor knew what was happening. The landlords knew what was happening. Postmen knew what was happening." She starts to cry, scrubs at her eyes with the heel of her hand. She shows him the tattoo in the center of her palm, the eye with the tendrils creeping out from it.
"This means we will never stop watching," she says, "like God watches over us."
At night, Tunde writes fast and urgently, a diary of sorts, notes from the war. This revolution will need its chronicler. It's going to be him. He has in mind a broad, sweeping book, with interviews, yes, and also assessments of the tide of history, region by region, analysis, nation by nation. Pulling out to see the shockwaves of the power slosh across the planet, zooming in tight to focus on single moments, single stories. Sometimes he writes with such intensity that he forgets that he doesn't have the power himself in his hands and the bones of his neck. It's going to be a big book. 900 pages, 1,000 pages. De Tocqueville's Democracy in America, Gibbon's Decline and Fall. There'll be an accompanying barrage of footage online, Landsman Shoah, reporting from inside the events as well as analysis and argument. He opens his chapter on Moldova with a description of the way the power was passed from hand to hand among the women, then proceeds to the new flowering of online religion and how it shored up support for women taking over towns, and then goes on to the inevitable revolution in the government of the country. Tunde interviews the president 5 days before the government falls. Viktor Moskalev is a small and sweaty man who has held this country together by making a series of alliances and by turning a blind eye to the vast organized crime syndicates that have been using his little unassuming nation as a staging post for their unsavory business. He moves his hands nervously during the interview, brushing the few strands of hair left on his head out of his eyes constantly, and dripping sweat across his bald head, even though the room is quite cool. His wife, Tatiana, an ex-gymnast who once almost competed at the Olympics, sits beside him, holding his hand. "President Moskalev," says Tunde, deliberately relaxing his voice, smiling. "Between you and me, what do you think is happening to your country?" Victor's throat muscles clench. They're sitting in the grand receiving room of his palace in Chisinau. Half the furniture is gilded. Tatiana strokes his knee and smiles. She also is gilded. Bronze highlights in her hair, glitter on the curve of her cheeks.
"All countries," says Victor slowly, "have had to adapt to the new reality."
Tunde leans back, crossing one leg over the other. "This isn't going out on the radio or on the internet, Victor. It's just for my book. I'd really like your assessment. 43 border towns are now effectively being run by paramilitary gangs, mostly composed of women who freed themselves from sexual slavery. What do you think your chances are of getting control back?"
"Our forces are already moving to quash these rebels," says Victor. "Within a few days, the situation will normalize."
Tunde raises a quizzical eyebrow, half laughs. Is Victor being serious? The gangs have captured weapons, body armor, and ammunition from the crime syndicates they've destroyed. They're virtually unbeatable.
"Sorry, what is it that you're planning to do? Bomb your own country to pieces? They're everywhere."
Victor smiles an enigmatic smile.
"If it has to be, that is how it must be. This trouble will pass in just a week or two."
Fucking hell. Maybe he really will bomb the whole country and end up sitting as president of a pile of rubble. Or maybe he just hasn't accepted what's really going on here. It'll make an interesting footnote in the book. With his country crumbling around him, President Moskalev seemed almost blasé. In the corridor outside, Tunde waits for an embassy car to take him back to his hotel. Safer to travel under the Nigerian flag here than under Moskalev's protection these days. But it can take 2 or 3 hours for the cars to make it through the security. That's where Tatiana Moskalev finds him, waiting on an embroidered chair for someone to call his cell and say that the car's ready. She clicks down the hallway in her spike heels. Her dress is turquoise, skin-tight, ruched, and cut to accentuate those strong gymnast's legs and those elegant gymnast's shoulders. She stands over him.
"You don't like my husband, do you?" she says.
"I wouldn't say that."
He smiles his easy smile.
"I would. Are you going to print something bad about him?"
Tunde rests his elbows on the back of the chair, opening his chest.
Tatiana, he says, if we're going to have this conversation, is there anything to drink in this palace?
There's brandy in a cabinet, in what looks like a 1980s movie idea of a Wall Street boardroom. High-shine gold plastic fittings and a dark wood table. She pours them each a generous measure, and they look out over the city together. The presidential palace is a high-rise in the center of town. From the outside, it looks like nothing so much as a mid-price four-star business hotel. Tatiana says,
He came to watch a performance at my school. I was a gymnast, performing in front of a minister for finance.
She drinks.
I was 17 and he was 42. But he took me out of that little nothing town.
Tunde says, The world's changing. And they exchange a little glance. She smiles.
You are going to be very successful.
She says,
You have the hunger. I've seen it before.
And you? Do you have the hunger?
She looks him up and down and makes a little laugh through her nose. She can't be more than 40 now herself.
Look what I can do,
she says, although he thinks he already knows what she can do. She puts her palm flat to the frame of the window and closes her eyes. The lights in the ceiling fizz and blink out. She looks up, sighs.
Why are they connected to the window frames?
Says Tunde.
Crappy wiring, she says, like everything in this place.
Does Victor know you can do it?
She shakes her head.
Hairdresser gave it to me. A joke. A woman like you, she said. You'll never need it. You're taken care of.
And are you? Says Tunde. Taken care of.
She laughs now properly, full-throatedly.
Be careful, she says. Victor would chop your balls off if he heard you talking that way.
Tunde laughs too.
Is it really Victor I have to be afraid of? Any more?
She takes a long, slow swig of her drink.
Do you want to know a secret?
She says.
Always, he says.
Awadi Atif, the new king of Saudi Arabia, is in exile in the north of our country. He's been feeding Victor money and arms. That's why Victor thinks he can crush the rebels.
Are you serious?
She nods.
Can you get me confirmation of that? Emails, faxes, photographs, anything?
She shakes her head.
Go and look for him. You're a clever boy. You'll work it out.
He licks his lips.
Why are you telling me this? I want you to remember me, she says, when you're very successful. Remember that we talked like this now.
Just talked,
says Tunde.
Your car is here, she says,
pointing to the long black limousine pulling through the cordon outside the building, 30 floors below them. It's 5 days after that when Victor Moskalev dies, quite suddenly and unexpectedly, of a heart attack in his sleep. It is something of a surprise to the world community when, in the immediate aftermath of his death, the Supreme Court of the country unanimously votes in emergency session to appoint his wife Tatiana as interim leader. In the fullness of time, there would be elections in which Tatiana would stand for office. But the most important thing is to maintain order at this difficult time. But, says Tunde in his report, Tatiana Moskalev may have been easy to underestimate. She was a political operator of skill and intelligence and had evidently used her leverage well. In her first public appearance, she wore a small gold brooch in the shape of an eye. Some said this was a nod to the growing popularity of goddess movements online. Some pointed out how very difficult it is to tell the difference between a skillful attack using the electrical power and an ordinary heart attack. but these rumors were without any evidential foundation. Transfers of power, of course, are rarely smooth. This one is complicated by a military coup, spearheaded by Victor's chief of defense, who takes more than half the army with him and manages to oust the Moskalev interim government from Chisinau. But the armies of women, freed from chains in those border towns, are broadly and instinctively with Tatiana Moskalev. Upwards of 300,000 women pass through the country every year, sold for the use of their moist bodies and fragile flesh. A great number of those have stayed, having nowhere else to go. On the 13th day of the 5th month of the 3rd year after the Day of the Girls, Tatiana Moskalev brings her wealth and her connections, a little less than half her army and many of her weapons, to a castle in the hills on the borders of Moldova. And there, she declares a new kingdom, uniting the coastal lands between the old forests and the great inlets, and thus, in effect, declaring war on 4 separate countries, including the Big Bear herself. She calls the new country Bessapara, after the ancient people who lived there and interpreted the sacred sayings of the priestesses on the mountaintops. The international community waits for the outcome. The consensus is that the state of Bessapara cannot hold for long. Tunde records it all in careful notes and documentations. He adds, "There is a scent of something in the air. A smell like rainfall after a long drought. First one person, then 5, then 500, then villages, then cities, then states. Bod to bod, and leaf to leaf. Something new is happening. The scale of the thing has increased." Roxy. There's a girl on the beach at high tide, lighting up the sea with her hands. The girls from the convent watch her from the cliff top. She's waded into the ocean up to her waist, higher. She's not even wearing a bathing suit, just jeans and a black cardigan. And she's setting the sea on fire. It's coming on to dusk, so they can see it clearly. Threads of kelp are spread in a fine, disorderly mesh across the surface of the water. And when she sends her power into the water, the particulate and debris glow dimly, and the seaweed brighter yet. The light extends in a wide circle around her, lit from beneath, like the great eye of the ocean gazing at the sky. There's a sound like popping candy as the branching limbs of the sargasso plant smolder and the buds swell and burst. There's a marine scent, salt and green and pungent. She must be half a mile away, but they can smell it from the cliff top. They think at any moment she must have used out her power, but it goes on. The flickering luminescence in the bay. The scent, as the crabs and small fish rise to the surface of the water. The women say to one another, "God will send her salvation."
"She has inscribed the circle on the face of the waters," says Sister Maria Ignatia. "She is at the boundary of light and darkness."
She is a sign from the Mother. They send word to Mother Eve. Someone has come. They'd given Roxy a choice of places to go. Bernie's got family in Israel. She could go to them. "Think about it, Rox. Sandy beaches, fresh air. You could go to school with Yuval's kids. He's got 2 girls about your age. And you've got to believe the Israelis aren't locking girls up for doing what you can do. They've already got them in the army. They're already training them up, Rox. I bet they know stuff you haven't even thought of." She looks it up on the internet, though. "They don't even speak English in Israel. Or write with English letters." Bernie tries to explain that most people in Israel do speak English, really, but Roxy still says, "Nah, don't think so." "Then her mum had family near the Black Sea." Bernie points it out on the map. "That's your grandma comes from there. You didn't ever meet your grandma, did you? Your mum's mum? There are still cousins there, still family connections. We do good business with those people too. You could get in with the business you said you want to." But Roxy had already decided where she wanted to go. "I'm not thick," she said.
I know you've got to get me out of the country because they're looking for who killed Primrose. It's not a holiday. And Bernie and the boys had stopped talking and just looked at her. You can't say that, Rox, said Ricky. Wherever you go, you just say you're on holiday, all right? I want to go to America, she said. I want to go to South Carolina. Look, there's that woman there, Mother Eve. She does them talks on the internet, you know? Ricky said, they'll know some people down that way. We can fix you up somewhere to stay, Rox. Someone to look after you. I don't need anyone to look after me. Ricky looked at Bernie. Bernie shrugged. After all she's been through, said Bernie. And that settled it. Ali sits on a rock and dabbles her fingers in the water. Every time the woman in the water discharges her power, she can feel it. Even at this distance, like a sharp smack. She says in her heart, what do you think? I've never seen anyone with this much strength in her. The voice says, didn't I tell you I was sending you a soldier? Ali says in her heart, does she know her destiny? The voice says, who does, sweet pea? It's dark now, and the lights from the freeway are barely visible here. Ali dips her hand into the ocean and sends out as much charge as she can. She barely sends a flicker across the water. It's enough. The woman in the waves walks towards her. It's too dark to see her face clearly. Ali calls out, you must be cold. I have a blanket here if you want it. The woman in the water says, bloody hell, what are you, search and rescue? I suppose you got a picnic there too, have you? She's British. This is unexpected. Still, the Almighty works in mysterious ways. Roxy, says the woman in the water. I'm Roxy. I'm, says Ali, and pauses. For the first time in a long while, she has the urge to tell this woman her real name. Ridiculous. I'm Eve, she says. Oh, my word, says Roxy. Oh, my Lord, it's only you I've blimmin' come to find, isn't it? Bloody hell, just got in this morning. Night flight is a killer, I'm telling you. Had a nap, thought I'd go looking for you tomorrow, and here you bloody are. It's a miracle. See, says the voice. What did I tell you? Roxy hauls herself up onto the flat stone next to Ali. She is suddenly and instantly impressive. She's muscular in her shoulders and arms, but it's more than that. Reaching out with that sense that she has honed and practiced, Ali tries to gauge how much power Roxy has in her skein. She feels that she is falling off the edge of the world. It goes on and on, as limitless as the ocean. Oh, she says, a soldier will come.
What's that now?
Ali shakes her head. Nothing. Something I heard once. Roxy gives her an appraising look.
You a bit spooky, then? That's what I thought when I saw your videos. Bit spooky, I thought. You'd do well on one of them TV shows, Most Haunted. You ever seen that? Actually, you don't have anything to eat, do you? I'm starving.
Ali pats down her pockets and finds a candy bar in her jacket. Roxy tears into it, taking huge bites.
That's better, she says. You know that thing when you've used up a lot of power and it just makes you starving hungry?
She pauses, looks at Ali.
No.
Why were you doing it? The light in the water?
Roxy shrugs. It's just an idea I had. Never been in the sea before, wanted to see what I could do.
She squints out at the ocean.
Think I'll kill a bloody load of fish. You could probably have dinner out of them all this week if you've got...
She juggles her hands.
I don't know, a boat and a net or something. I suppose some of them might be poison. You get poison fish, or is it just like jaws and that?
Ali laughs in spite of herself. It's been a while since someone last made her laugh. Since she last laughed without deciding beforehand that laughing was the smart thing to do.
She just had an idea, says the voice. It just popped into her head.
She came looking for you. I told you a soldier would come.
Yeah, says Ellie. Shut up for a minute, okay?
What made you come to look for me? Says Ellie.
Roxy shifts her shoulders as if she's darting and weaving, escaping imaginary blows. I had to get out of England for a bit, and I saw you on YouTube. She takes a breath, lets it all out, smiles at herself and then says, Look, I don't know, all those things you talk about where you say that God's made this all happen for a reason and women are supposed to take over from men. I don't believe in any of that God stuff, all right?
All right.
But I think, like, do you know what they're teaching girls in school in England? Breathing exercises. No kidding, bleeding, breathing. Bleeding, keep it under control, don't use it, don't do anything, keep yourself nice and keep your arms crossed. You know what I mean? And, like, I had sex with a bloke a few weeks back, and he was practically begging me to do it to him, just a little bit. He'd seen it on the internet. No one's going to keep their arms crossed forever. My dad's all right and my brothers are all right, they're not bad, but I wanted to talk to you, because you're like, you're thinking about what it means, for the future, you know? It's exciting.
It comes out of her in a big rush.
What do you think it means? Says Ellie.
Everything's gonna change, says Roxy, picking at the seaweed with one hand while she talks.
Stands to reason, doesn't it? We've all got to find some new way to work together on it. You know, blokes have got a thing they can do, they're strong, women have got a thing now too. And there's still guns, they don't stop working, lots of blokes with guns. I'm no match for them. I feel like... it's exciting, you know? I was saying this to my dad, the stuff we could do together.
Ellie laughs. Do you think they'll want to work with us?
Well, some of them yeah, some of them no, right? But the sensible ones will. I was talking about it with my dad. Do you ever get that feeling when you're in a room and you can tell which girls around you got loads of power and which have got none? You know, like spider sense.
This is the first time Ellie has ever heard anyone else talk about this sense. She has particularly acutely.
Yes, she says. I think I know what you mean. Bloody hell, no one knows what I mean. Not that I've talked about it with loads of people. Anyway, that... useful to be able to tell the blokes, right? Useful to work together.
Ellie flattens her lips. I see it a bit differently, you know?
Yeah, mate, I know you do. I've seen your stuff.
I think there's going to be a great battle between light and darkness, and your destiny is to fight on our side. I think you will be mightiest in the mightiest.
Roxy laughs and chucks a pebble into the sea. I always fancied having a destiny, she says. Look, can we go somewhere? Yours or somewhere? It's bloody freezing out here.
They let her come to Terry's funeral. It was a bit like Christmas. There was aunties and uncles and booze and bridge rolls and hard-boiled eggs. There was people putting an arm round her and telling her she's a good girl. And Ricky gave her some stuff before they set off, and he took some himself and went, just to take the edge off. So it felt like snow was falling, like it was cold and high up, just like Christmas. At the grounds, Barbara, Terry's mum, went to throw a trail of dirt onto the coffin. When the earth hit the wood, she made a long, wailing cry. There was a car parked and blokes with long-lens cameras taking pictures. Ricky and some of his mates scared them off. When they came back, Bernie said, Paps. And Ricky said, could be police, working with. Roxy's in a bit of trouble over this, probably. They were all right to her at the reception, but at the grounds, none of the mourners knew where to put their faces when she walked past. At the convent, supper is already being served when Ellie and Roxy arrive. There's a place saved for them at the head of the table, and there's chatter, and the smell of good, warm food. It's a stew with clams and mussels and potatoes and corn. There's crusty bread and apples. Roxy has a feeling she can't quite name, can't really place. It makes her a little bit soft inside, a bit teary. One of the girls finds her a change of clothes, a warm knitted jumper and a pair of sweatpants all warm and cosy from being washed so often.
and that's just how she feels, too.
The girls all want to chat to her. They've never heard an accent like hers, and they make her say water and banana. There's so much talking. Roxy always thought she was a bit of a blabbermouth, but this is something else. After supper, Mother Eve gives a little lesson in the scripture. They're finding scripture that works for them, rewriting the bits that don't. Mother Eve speaks on the story of the Book of Ruth. She reads out the passage where Ruth tells her mother-in-law, her friend, "Don't tell me to leave you. Whither thou goest, I shall go. Your people shall be my people. Your God will be my God." Mother Eve is easy amongst these women, in a way Roxy finds difficult. She's not used to the company of girls. It's been boys in Bernie's family, and boys in Bernie's gang, and her mum was always more of a man's woman, and the girls at school never treated Roxy nice. Mother Eve's not awkward like Roxy here. She holds the hands of two of the girls sitting next to her, and speaks softly and with humour. She says, "That story about Ruth, that's the most beautiful story of friendship in the whole of the Bible. No one was ever more faithful than Ruth. No one ever expressed the bonds of friendship better." There are tears in her eyes as she speaks, and the girls around the table are already moved. "It's not for us to worry about the men," she says. "Let them please themselves, as they always have. If they want to war with each other and to wander, let them go. We have each other. Where you go, I will go. Your people will be my people, my sisters." And they say, "Amen." Upstairs, they've made a bed up for Roxy. It's just a little room. A single bed with a hand-stitched quilt across it, a table and chair, a view of the ocean. She wants to weep when they open the door, but she doesn't show it. She remembers quite suddenly, as she sits on the bed and feels the coverlet under her hand, a night when her dad brought her back to his house, the house he lived in with Barbara and with Roxy's brothers. It was late at night, and her mum was ill with vomiting, and she'd called Bernie to pick up Roxy, and he'd come. She was in her pyjamas. She can't have been more than 5 or 6. She remembers Barbara saying, "Well, she can't stay here." And Bernie going, "For fuck's sake, just put her in the guest room." And Barbara crossing her arms across her bosom and going, "I told you, she's not staying here. Send her to your brothers if you have to." It was raining that night, and her dad carried her back out to the car, the drops falling past the hood of her dressing gown to fall on her chest. There's someone expecting Roxy this evening, sort of. Someone will catch her in the neck if they've lost her, anyway. But she's 16, and one text will sort that out. Mother Eve closes the door, so it's just the two of them in the little room. She sits on the chair and says, "You can stay as long as you like." "Why?" "I've got a good feeling about you." Roxy laughs. "Would you have a good feeling about me if I was a boy?" "But you're not a boy." "Do you have a good feeling about all women?" Mother Eve shakes her head. "Not this good." "Do you want to stay?" "Yeah," says Roxy. "For a bit anyway. See what you're up to here. I like your, She searches for the word. "I like how it feels here." Mother Eve says, "You're strong, aren't you? Strong as anyone."
"Stronger than anyone, mate. Is that why you like me?"
"We can use someone strong."
"Yeah? You got big plans?"
Mother Eve leans forward, puts her hands on her knees.
"I want to save the women," she says.
"What, all of them?"
Roxy laughs.
"Yes," says Mother Eve, "if I can. I want to reach them and tell them that there are new ways to live now, that we can band together, that we can let men go their own way, that we don't need to stick to the old order. We can make a new path."
"Oh, yeah. You do need a few blokes to make babies, you know."
Mother Eve smiles.
All things are possible with God's help.
Ali's phone beeps. She looks at it, makes a face, turns it over so she can't see the screen.
What's up?
Says Roxy. People keep emailing the convent. Trying to get you out of here? Nice place. I can see why they'd want it back.
Trying to give us money.
Roxy laughs.
What's the problem? Got too much?
Ali looks at Roxy thoughtfully for a moment. Only Sister Maria Ignatia has a bank account, and I... She runs her tongue over her top front teeth, makes her lips click. Roxy says, You don't trust no one, do you?
Ali smiles. Do you?
Price of doing business, mate. Gotta trust someone or you'll get nothing done. You need a bank account? How many do you want? Want some out of the country? Cayman Islands is good, I think. Don't know why.
Wait, what do you mean?
But before Ali can stop her, Roxy's taken out her phone, snapped a picture of Ali and is sending a text. Roxy grins.
Trust me. Gotta find some way to pay my rent, don't I?
A man arrives at the convent before 7 o'clock the next morning. He drives up to the front gate and just waits there. Roxy knocks on Ali's door, drags her down the driveway in her dressing gown.
What?
What is it? Says Ali. But she's smiling.
Come and see.
All right, Einar,
says Roxy to the man. He's stocky, mid-40s, dark hair, wearing a pair of sunglasses on his forehead. Einar grins and nods slowly.
You okay here, Roxanne? Bernie Monk said to look after you. Are you being looked after?
On grand, Einar, says Roxy. Super duper.
Just gonna stay with me mates here for a few weeks, I reckon. You got what I need?
Einar laughs at her.
I met you in London once, Roxanne. You were 6 years old, and you kicked me in the shins when I wouldn't buy you a milkshake while we waited for your dad.
Roxy laughs too, easily.
This is simpler for her than the dinner.
Ali can see it.
Should have bought me a milkshake then, shouldn't you? Come on, hand it over.
There's a bag with, clearly, some of Roxy's clothes and other things in. There's a laptop, brand new, top of the range. And there's a little zip-up case. Roxy balances it on the edge of the open car boot and unzips it.
Careful, says Einar. Rush job. Ink will still smudge if you rub it.
Got that, Evie? Says Roxy.
No rubbing them till they're dry.
Roxy hands her a few items from inside the case. They're passports, US ones, driver's licenses, social security cards, all as legitimate looking as if they'd been made up by the government themselves. And all the licenses and all the passports have her photo in. Changed a bit each time. Different hair, a couple of them with glasses. And different names, to match the names on the social security cards and the licenses. But her, every time.
We did you 7, says Roxy. 6 and 1 for luck. 7th one's UK, case you fancy it. Do you manage to get the bank accounts, Einar?
All set up, says Einar, fishing another smaller zip-up wallet out of his pocket.
But no deposits over 100,000 in one day, without talking to us first, all right?
Dollars or pounds, says Roxy.
Einar winces slightly.
Dollars, he says, then hurriedly. But only for the first 6 weeks. Then they take the checks off the accounts.
Fine, says Roxy.
I won't kick you in the shins.
This time.
Roxy and Daryl kicked around in the garden for a bit, tearing at stones and picking bark off the tree. Neither of them ever even liked Terry that much. But it's weird now he's gone.
Daryl went, What did it feel like?
And Roxy was like,
I wasn't down there when they got Terry.
And Daryl went, Nah, I mean when you did Primrose. What did it feel like? She felt it again. The glitter under her palm. The way his face grew warm and then cold. She sniffed. Looked at her own hand as if it could tell her the answer.
It felt good, she said.
He killed my mum.
Daryl said, I wish I could do it.
Roxanne Monk and Mother Eve talk a lot in the next few days. They find the things they have in common and hold them out at arm's length to admire the details. The missing mother. The place they're both used to holding, half in and half out of families. I like how you all say sister here. I never had a sister.
I didn't either,
says Ali. Always wanted one, says Roxy. And they leave that there for a bit. Some of the girls in the convent want to spar with Roxy, practice their skills. She's up for it. They use the big lawn at the back of the building, leading down to the ocean. She takes them two or three at once, sidesteps them, hits them hard, confuses them till they jolt each other. They come in for supper.